I know you're busy, but if you have a minute, we'd love if you could take a survey about your podcast listening. And while you're at it, you can tell us more about what you like or don't like about Here and Now. The survey is anonymous, and we want to hear from everyone, those of you who've been listening to Here and Now for years, those of you who've just found us. It only takes a couple of minutes. It's at npr.org/podcast survey.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Biden is on his way to Europe today for the first international trip of his presidency. He's leaving a set of collapsed infrastructure talks behind. The president told a group of Republicans yesterday he'd no longer work with them. Now he's turning to a different bipartisan group of senators, and he's also hedging his bets, telling Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer to prepare an infrastructure plan using budget reconciliation without Republican support, if necessary. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us now. Kelsey, welcome.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Biden had been talking to Republican Senator Shelley Moore Capito for weeks about infrastructure. Why did he pull the plug yesterday?
They were just so far apart. One of the things that we heard over and over again from Biden and from, you know, Jen Psaki, the White House press secretary, was that his patience with all of these negotiations was not infinite, that they wanted a deal. And there's a lot of pressure because the Senate wants to move forward with an infrastructure bill sometime in, you know, in July. And, you know, it is quickly approaching. July is not that far off now. And if they want to come up with an agreement or anything that can start to move in the Senate, they have to start negotiating with Democrats, because there's not exactly a clear picture about what they all support, where this is going. There's a lot more work to do, and they can't be stuck in a negotiation where it just doesn't look like they can bridge the gap.
So who is involved in this new group of 20 senators that the president has started working with?
Yeah, it is 20 senators. It's a big group, and it's being led by Mitt Romney of Utah and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, a Democrat from Arizona, who is one of the main moderates that we've been watching because she, like Joe Manchin of West Virginia, has been opposed to moving things on a partisan basis and has been opposed to blowing up the filibuster to get things done. So we're watching this group to see how far they can get. But one thing I will note is that the larger a group is, the harder it sometimes is to get agreement amongst them all. So it will be interesting to see if they can make any real progress before President Biden and Senate leadership says, you know, enough's enough, it's time to move on.
Though if you can get them to agree on something, that's a big chunk of senators right there. Republican Mitt Romney, as you said, is part of this. He said today that he didn't want a tax increase to pay for infrastructure spending. That's among the things that sunk earlier negotiations. Where do we stand there?
Yeah, that is a really important question, is if Republicans are saying that they are unwilling to do anything that unwinds the 2017 tax law that passed under President Trump, and they're unwilling to make any other additional tax changes, that leaves a very small universe of ways to pay for things in this bill. They talk about things like user fees, which could mean taxes and highway fees, and it can mean any number of like ports fees, things that people who are using the services have to pay. Now, Democrats generally have not supported that, and if they cannot get together on how to pay for things, they really just can't start moving forward with policies either. So in a lot of ways, the way to pay for a bill is almost as big of a challenge as the actual legislation that they write.
Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer told reporters yesterday that Democrats may pass some of this agenda on infrastructure through reconciliation. Of course, this is the same process that they used to pass COVID relief without Republicans. Let's listen to Schumer here.
It may well be that part of the bill that will pass will be bipartisan and part of it will be through reconciliation. But we're not going to sacrifice the bigness and boldness in this bill. We will just pursue two paths, and at some point they will join.
Can you explain what we're hearing there from Chuck Schumer? And how could they pass any part of any bill with reconciliation if it has to go through Democrats like Joe Manchin?
That is a really good question, and I think that is the thing that is the big question that Democrats are facing and are trying to kind of work their way through is if they break things apart, if they decide to move just a small bit of infrastructure where they can agree on user fees, they can agree on these narrow ways to pay for it, and they can do it with Republicans, great, Democrats are excited about that. But if they have to break it off and do it through budget reconciliation, they do need unanimous support among Democrats. And again, that goes back to the question of what will people like Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema and a number of other moderate senators who have kind of stayed away from commenting or taking a position on all of this stuff. It'll be up to them to start deciding where their red line is. Where is the universe of options that are absolutely necessary for them to show up and vote for a potentially massive package.
Okay, I know you mentioned a July deadline, but could you just talk about the time frame here real quick?
Yeah, the July is the ideal space that Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer has talked about. In part, that's because they want to try to move things before they get deep into August recess, before senators have to go home and see constituents and then, you know, quickly slide into the fall, which quickly slides into campaign season. I know that seems very fast, but we are already in Washington thinking about the next election cycle, and next year is a very important midterm election when a large portion of the Senate is up for re-election. So they want to get moving so that they can get something done before they have to start to campaign.
Can't talk about the fall yet. We've just got started here.
In Washington, NPR, we're already that far ahead.
No kidding. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
And sorry, Peter, but we're going to keep doing that. We're going to Virginia, where former Governor Terry McAuliffe won the Democratic nomination for governor last night. He'll face Republican candidate Glenn Youngkin in the general election in November. The gubernatorial election in Virginia is often seen as the first test for the party in power at the White House. Virginia's electorate has been moving steadily to the left, abolishing the death penalty, legalizing marijuana. So can Republicans form a united front against McAuliffe heading into the general election this fall? Ben Pavier covers state politics for member station BPM. Hi, Ben.
Hi.
So current Governor Ralph Northam, who's a Democrat, is term limited by Virginia law. He can't run consecutively. He can run again down the road, which is what former Virginia Governor Terry McAuliffe is doing now. Here he is in his acceptance speech last night.
I don't have to tell you about the progress that we have made over the last 8 years under my administration and Governor Northam. We are a different state than we were 8 years ago, and we are not going back.
So there's McAuliffe tying himself to Governor Northam. It's worth reminding listeners about the news 2 years ago that Northam admitted to using blackface in the past. He said it was to portray Michael Jackson. He apologized. But the primary was more focused on the progressive politics that he's championed. What does this say about the platform McAuliffe is offering?
Well, Robin, McAuliffe kind of pinch hit for Northam when he had a cloud over him because of that scandal in 2019. And that allowed Democrats to flip the state legislature. And since then, as you mentioned, they've abolished the death penalty. They've legalized possession of marijuana. They've passed gun control, LGBTQ protections, raised the minimum wage, expanded absentee voting. These are all things that McAuliffe would have liked to do in his first term, I think at least some of those things, and wasn't able to because of a Republican majority. And so I think he sees himself as setting the stage for that to happen, and now he sees himself as building on that legacy if he wins again.
Yeah, and he will face Republican Glenn Youngkin, as we said, in the general election. Youngkin has cast himself as a political outsider, but he already has former President Donald Trump's endorsement. Is that a blessing or a curse in a state like Virginia?
It's a great question. I think it's really a mixed blessing in Virginia. I mean, Trump lost Virginia by 10 points. Glenn Youngkin is pitching himself as this outsider. He's a former CEO of the Carlyle Group, an investment group. He's got no political experience. He really emerged from nowhere. I think, very few people heard of Glenn Youngkin in Virginia politics until the last 6 months. And he's very wealthy. And so he's kind of trying to portray himself. I've heard him described as a country club Republican, someone Republicans believe could help them win back the suburbs. But, he's going to have to explain his record winning the nomination for the Republican convention, where he played up connections to Trump. He campaigned with Texas Senator Ted Cruz, who was a Trump ally who challenged those election results. Now Youngkin's changed his tune and says Biden's election is legitimate. And he's talking much more about these sort of culture war issues. But he's really just trying to get a word in with these suburban voters who kind of tuned the GOP out in the Trump years. But it's possible the damage has already been done.
Well, Youngkin has already spent $12 million on this race. McAuliffe, seen as one of the Democratic Party's top fundraisers, so this is going to get expensive. And as we mentioned, it's crucial to Democrats. It's a bellwether for the 2022 midterms. Why?
There's a national trend, as you know, where the party in the White House tends to lose seats in Congress in the midterms. And in Virginia, kind of there's a corollary here where the party in the White House almost always loses the governor's mansion in Virginia's off-year elections. McAuliffe is the only exception to that going back to the 1970s, his win in 2013. So the question now is, will we see that kind of backlash to Biden and Democrats this year? And Virginia is an early test of that. But it's an imperfect test because I think Virginia is really not seen as a swing state anymore. It's really leaned blue in the last decade. Republicans haven't won here since 2009. So we might get some indication of how the midterms play out from Virginia, but it's not a sure thing.
Well, and what about the role of former President Trump? What about state Republicans? What will they coalesce around?
I think Republicans are very excited about Glenn Youngkin. He's got the wealth. He's charismatic. He doesn't have a record for too much of a record anyway, aside from what he said ahead of the convention to run on. So, but Trump really brought nothing but bad news for Republicans. And as I mentioned, Youngkin has tied himself to Trump. He's now kind of backtracking a little bit. But, Trump cost them a lot of seats. There's no denying that his platform has gotten smaller, but he's not gone. And you see his influence everywhere. Youngkin has talked a lot about tightening Virginia's voting laws. He's talked about critical race theory. So the question is, can the GOP escape his shadow? And do they really want to?
Yeah. Ben Pavier, state politics reporter for VPM there in Virginia. Ben, thank you.
Thank you for having me.
So for many, the pandemic is over. Time for summer camp, vacations. Many of us will still wear masks, but we're stepping out. There are also millions of Americans still grieving those who died and are still dying of COVID-19. And what about the people who tried to save them? Over the last year, Maryland psychotherapist Carrie Maloista noticed frontline healthcare workers struggling with what she called the ghosts of the COVID deaths they carry, borrowing the expression from Tim O'Brien's exquisite collection of Vietnam War-era stories, The Things They Carried. Well, to help healthcare workers in this present-day frontline, and inspired by two paintings that we'll post at herenow.org, Carrie started the Things They Carry Project, a series of writing workshops for healthcare workers and first responders, each session guided by a known writer and a therapist who, together, help doctors, nurses, hospital, domestic workers understand it's okay to lay down their burdening thoughts. Carrie Maloista, welcome.
Thank you.
And Michael Schmitz is here as well. He's an emergency doctor practicing in Biddeford, Maine. He's been participating in the workshops. Dr. Schmitz, Mike, welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
And Carrie, what were you hearing?
I had a couple patients who were, working in the front lines, one an ICU worker, another an ER doc. And it was at the year anniversary of the pandemic in March that the grief really was starting to hit them. It was like things were finally slowing down, and I was hearing just the pain they were feeling. And it was with one doc that I said, what about just trying to write down these feelings and express them? Because he found he had no words for them. And when he came back in and told me how helpful it was, and he was continuing to write, it just immediately took off as an idea of what about if we offered this?
And Dr. Schmitz, Mike, how were you feeling about expressing emotions when a doctor has to be so strong for the patients?
Especially in the emergency department, the public sort of has a stereotype of, that you sort of run in and maybe do things and maybe don't feel them or don't carry them with you. And of course, the opposite is very much true. All those experiences are still with you.
Well, a lot of people died this past year. What was it that you were carrying?
How wearing PPE and gowns and masks, while they were necessary, they also disrupted a lot of the things about the way I'm used to communicating with other people, especially meeting someone for the first time. The face is so expressive. That's how we connect. And to have half of your face covered certainly makes it more challenging. Outside of that, there's, everyone has a family to take care of and kids who have to adapt to school. You throw in Facebook and social media and all the commentary, and it can be a lot.
What do you mean, Facebook?
People commenting about COVID and is it real and that kind of stuff.
Oh, well. Meantime, what were you seeing?
First and foremost, was elderly patients quite sick, couldn't communicate with their family members because of the COVID restrictions. And again and again and again. Yeah. You know, one of the things that I remember that was the most difficult was working on Christmas and calling people's families. You're away from your own family. You are helping people, which is your job, but also giving people some of the worst news on Christmas that their loved one who they can't see is in the hospital and probably has COVID. Those phone calls were tough.
Yeah. What is it that you felt you were carrying?
It's just a weight of those experiences. The best word I would use is just a weight. I wouldn't call it grief. In my particular case, I would just say that it was a weight. And this program made a space to put it down.
Mm. Carrie, Dr. Mm-hmm. Maluista, we should mention you know a thing or two about carrying a weight. Your daughter Sarah died at 18. She was an artist before that was even conceivable that she would pass. And you looked at a painting with her, Millais the Gleaners, Women Harvesting Wheat. And you've said that she taught you about, in painting, the foreground, the background, and something called the middle ground. I'm so sorry. Inconceivable. Loss of a child. Inconceivable. But can you explain how you were able to, you know, work your way out of that through this idea of finding that middle distance?
There was a Georgia O'Keeffe painting called The Far Away Nearby. It's a painting of this massive elk skull and antlers, very right up in your face, large. And then in the background is this distant mountains. And seeing it, you're off kilter. It was missing what's called the middle distance. And I had learned that term from my daughter because she was showing me the picture of the gleaners and explaining the term to me. She said it's what gives a painting balance and perspective. And it was something about those words, the far away nearby. It just struck me that we do need a middle distance in life, too. And that when we go through something traumatic, at first we're in the nearby of all we feel is grief and overwhelming trauma, and we can't see past it. And then we have the idea of the far away, where we feel so distant and deny the affect and feel lost, which is also not a good place. And so I came to think how we really need a middle distance to bridge those two worlds in order to go on and live a good, full, and creative life. One that both includes the loss and the grief, we can't get rid of that completely, but also can see a distance where we might be okay and carry, you know, the loved one with us. For me, one way was writing, and I learned personally how healing that was, and then I thought I could put that to use in this project.
We'll post pictures of both Millais' work and Georgia O'Keeffe's work, and in Millais' piece, the middle distance is haystacks, and I'll never look at them right. The same way again, you know? It's. But Mike, does that make any sense to you?
Absolutely. I think there's a way in, can you shift between the up close, the middle distance, and the far away so that you can do what you need to do when you're taking care of a patient, but then you also process or address the feelings and things that come afterwards.
Yeah. And Dr. Smits, I'm wondering, do you have any of your writing there?
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I wrote something about the mask, a green mask that we have to wear, the N95 mask, about how it's thick with microfilaments and cupping my nose and mouth, not quite smothering, but hopefully protecting, muffling not just my words, but the timing, the cadence of my speech, my patience, and my smile. The conscious work of breathing to now get the words out, counteracted only by my gloved hand resting upon a naked forearm, in a meager attempt to make up the chasm in the boundaries of our communication, trying to say, I've got you, and it's going to be okay.
Oh, wow. No, that gave me chills.
Thank you.
Ooh, what did that do for you to be able to write that?
There was definitely a release. And the thing that was the most helpful was that other people also talked about how these boundaries around COVID, whether it was a computer screen because they were doing mental health support for people or wearing PPE, how that affected their ability to care for other people. And they had many of the same fears and frustrations.
And what's been so interesting, too, is the range of, you know, a firefighter with a man who was doing burials with a doctor, all sharing their own grief. And I think at first people are numb, sort of like soldiers. You're going through one foot in front of the other and you have no option. And then suddenly, like I saw in March, when you can slow down, that's when you start to feel.
Yeah. And Mike, of course, you know, there were times when you could say, I got you and it's going to be okay. Mm-hmm. But it's not. Yeah. You know, what do you want people to say to you as we're all, you're up in Biddeford, Maine. You're about to have an invasion of tourists. What do you want people to say to you?
The most powerful thing that people have said is just thank you. Those are the words that go in the little bank that you hold in the center of your chest and that get you through the more difficult times.
Thank you, Dr. Michael Schmitz, an emergency physician there in Biddeford, Maine. Thank you so much.
Happy to be here. Thank you for your time.
And Dr. Carrie Malawista, who launched the project, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robin.
I just wanted to express my thanks. I think I can speak for the group of people that I was with that, you know, the benefit of this is you are connecting with other people, regardless of their degrees or specialty, who are like you in that they're willing to be accountable to each other, they're willing to confront the difficult feelings, and most importantly, as overwhelming as COVID and the pandemic have been, they're focused on serving others. Dr. Malawista, I'm so grateful for your efforts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mike.
Well, to find out more about the Things They Carry project or to sign up for a session, go to herenow.org, where you'll also find writing samples and those inspirational paintings.
What happens to police officers who get caught stealing, lying, or tampering with evidence? Each week, we open up an internal affairs investigation that used to be secret to find out how well the police themselves. Listen to On Our Watch, a podcast from NPR and KQED.
Planning your first international trip post-vaccination? Well, you'll be happy to know that the CDC's list of low-risk destinations is growing. Now, Iceland, Singapore, Israel, and South Korea are a part of the lowest COVID risk category. The CDC's updated travel guidelines include 120 countries around the world. Let's bring in Here and Now transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Hey, Seth.
Hey, Peter.
So the new CDC guidance gives advice for both vaccinated and unvaccinated travelers. Break it down for us. What are some of the safest and riskiest places on the list?
Well, you mentioned some of the safest ones. Iceland would be notable in terms of a place where some Americans, particularly those toward the East Coast, can easily go. Singapore. And really, there's little rhyme or reason from a geographical standpoint to which are the safest and which are the most vulnerable. Because on the other hand, it's not as though all of the most dangerous ones are in one part of the world. Among the most dangerous, you've got some South American countries like Argentina, Colombia, but also other European countries. Belgium, Sweden is one of them. So think about that. Two Nordic countries, Iceland among the safest in the world, and Sweden right now among the worst from that perspective.
Well, to that point, the Delta variant is spreading through the United Kingdom right now. Even though their numbers have been going way down, the risks seem to be going up in some ways. How's the CDC trying to help people better understand how to navigate all that?
Right. And you asked also before about the vaccinated versus unvaccinated. The CDC, to be clear, is saying people who are not vaccinated should not travel outside the U.S., even to those safest places. If you are vaccinated, they've greatly broadened where they're saying, yeah, be very careful, but go. There are basically these four groups of countries in terms of risk level, and it's only the ones with the very highest risk level where they're saying, just don't go if you can avoid going. So a country like the United Kingdom is in the third category. They go from one to four, best to worst. And United Kingdom, they're saying, make sure you are fully vaccinated before traveling there. They say the same thing about a lot of other countries in the world, you know, everywhere from Andorra to the United Arab Emirates. Mm. And so, yeah, basically the Delta variant, as far as the epidemiologists can tell, on average has a much greater chance of landing you in the hospital if you catch it, and the vaccines are perhaps less effective about against it. That's true regardless of where you catch it, but the UK, a place that has it right now.
Yeah. What can you tell us about Japan? The U.S. State Department said just last month, don't go there ahead of the Olympics in July.
Yeah, and Japan now is in that same category as the UK, where they're saying if you're fully vaccinated, you can go. And that's separate from the broader debate about, you know, whether the Olympics should be there, and from Japan's perspective, whether it wants people from all over the world coming to the country. But the CDC is saying that if you're fully vaccinated, based on the data available today, they're constantly updating this, it's a place that you can go, albeit with taking those same precautions that you would take in a lot of other countries.
And just real briefly, Seth, if you could tell us about a new policy at United and Delta that say new hires there must be fully vaccinated against COVID.
Yeah, and that's the key. New hires, right? They're not requiring existing employees to get vaccinated. And this is going to be a broader debate in society among a lot of lawyers, among others, in terms of what you can require. Always easier to require something of a new employee than of somebody who's already there. Let's see, Peter, if other airlines follow suit.
We shall indeed. Here and now, transportation analyst Seth Kaplan. Thank you.
Thank you.
June Pride. June is Pride Month, rather, and we are going to take a moment now to track the evolution of a politician on the issue of marriage equality. President Biden once believed that marriage should remain between a man and a woman, but in the past 25 years, he has evolved dramatically and has arguably been at the forefront of the LGBTQ movement. Sasha Eisenberg is the author of a new book, The Engagement: America's Quarter-Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage. Sasha, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
And why don't we start with the Defense of Marriage Act, which Senator Joe Biden and many other Democrats voted for in 1996. Tell us about that legislation and his support for it at the time.
So this was the first effort to deal with same-sex marriage in federal law. And this is really the first time that same-sex marriage became a political issue around the United States in any way. It was a response to a court decision in Hawaii in 1993, which became the first court to recognize that the right to marriage could extend to same-sex couples. And the Defense of Marriage Act had been introduced by Republicans to say that the federal government would not have to acknowledge any same-sex marriages that states had done on their own. And Biden was in the mainstream of, you know, not just American politics, but the Democratic Party. Only 14 Democrats voted against the Defense of Marriage Act. Bill Clinton signed it into law, and, you know, Biden sort of went along with the tide then.
Well, in the arc of history, it wasn't really that long ago. How painful was that law to the gay community?
So immediately, I think it was symbolically very painful. Gay activists had gone through the Don't Ask, Don't Tell experience with the Clinton White House. They saw this as a betrayal from somebody who had run pledging to be an ally to them. But nobody was immediately harmed by this. What this did was it explained that under federal law, any reference to marriage applied only to a man and a woman. But since there was nowhere in the United States that gay couples were able to legally marry until 2004, it took about 8 years for individual couples to feel any harm in their lives as a result of it.
Well, by 2006, Joe Biden still hadn't moved much. Here he is on Meet the Press on whether he supported a constitutional amendment to ban gay marriage.
We already have a law, the Defense of Marriage Act. We've all voted, not where I voted and others said, look, marriage is between a man and a woman and states must respect that. Nobody's violated that law. There's been no challenge to that law. Why do we need a constitutional amendment? Marriage is between a man and a woman.
A constitutional amendment defining marriage as between a man and a woman was actually then part of the debate leading up to the 2008 presidential election. Of course, Joe Biden was the vice presidential candidate. At that point, where was he among other Democrats in marriage equality?
He was still in the mainstream, and the thing that had changed was this went from being a two-sided issue in 1996, are you for or against same-sex marriage, to a three-sided issue, which is, do you support civil unions? Civil unions had emerged in 2000 in Vermont as a compromise that had basically been forced on the legislature and the governor by the state Supreme Court. And civil unions were an effort to create the institution of marriage with, you know, all the rights and benefits, but without using the word marriage, so as to avoid a lot of the sort of religious, moral, traditionalist arguments against it. And this became the sort of safe position for just about every national Democrat with any ambition. And so this is where, in the mid-2000s, this is where John Kerry is, this is where Hillary Clinton is, this is where Joe Biden is, and this is where Barack Obama is. And so their position is always that we support giving gay couples the same rights and benefits, but we don't want to change marriage. It's between a man and a woman, and amending the Constitution is too much and too far.
Well, 6 years later, in 2012, the vice president was on Meet the Press again. Let's listen.
I am absolutely comfortable with the fact that men marrying men, women marrying women, and heterosexual men and women married men are entitled to the same exact rights, all the civil liberties. And quite frankly, I don't see much of a distinction beyond that.
That is a complete about face. What happened? Where did the change come from?
Public opinion moved. You know, by that moment in 2012, you know, Biden announces his view. Obama does so 3 days later. Over 50% of the American people support same-sex marriage. This has been, you know, one of the reasons I wrote this book is that pollsters say that this is the biggest shift they've seen on public opinion on a single issue. And one thing that happens is this is an issue where politicians have consistently been followers of public opinion rather than leaders of it. And Biden and Obama were moving to where their party was. It was going to be very difficult for them to run for re-election in 2012 and start a second term if they were out of sync with the Democratic Party and by then a majority of American people on this.
Well, as you say, Joe Biden got out in front of his boss here on this issue. Here's President Obama, former President Obama, 3 days after Biden's interview. He said this to ABC News.
At a certain point, I've just concluded that for me personally, it is important for me to go ahead and affirm that I think same-sex couples should be able to get married.
So you say these two important politicians were following their party. Still, I mean, how significant was that moment that the vice president and then the president came out and said this?
Remarkable. This is an issue that we think of as a kind of moral question that's sort of static. And so it is really pronounced, I think, when a politician basically says, I was wrong. And Obama did a far better job than Biden about choosing his words here and talked about it as an evolution. And it's an evolution that mimics what almost 50% of the American people have gone through. Gallup this week says that 70% of Americans support same-sex marriage. In 1996, when Joe Biden voted for the Defense of Marriage Act, it was 27%. That is as dramatic as anything.
Well, and talk about that shift and how it happened so quickly.
I mean, some big part of it is individuals coming out as gay or lesbian, and their families, friends, coworkers, recognizing that they know somebody who's gay and seeing them in relationships. That's something that, you know, Biden has talked about, the sort of pop culture influence. Obama talked more about the generational difference, that his daughters had grown up with friends whose parents were in same-sex relationships, and that for them it was a fact of life, and he didn't see any reason why the law shouldn't reflect that. And I think that we see in polling is pretty consistent with what many Americans have experienced.
But I think it's fair to say that the mood shifted again by the time Donald Trump moved into the White House and then 4 years later out of the White House. He was not considered an ally. What kind of hopes were pinned on Joe Biden when he became the president?
So Biden, by dint of having sort of beaten Obama to announcing his reversal, became a big champion within the gay community, was seen as a hero. And so I think that there are a lot of expectations. And, you know, the issue has now moved. Obviously, the Supreme Court has ruled, you know, marriage is a settled question, but now we're talking about trans rights. We're talking about religious liberty issues, and lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender activists have a lot more invested in greater expectations, frankly, for Biden as he begins his term as president than they did when he became vice president in 2009.
Well, he is trying. It sounds like here's the president giving a speech to a joint session of Congress in April.
For all transgender Americans watching at home, especially young people, you're so brave. I want you to know your president has your back.
So as you suggested there, trans rights now the political center of the debate here in the United States. Do you think that will be complicated for the president to navigate?
I think he feels pretty safe that it is at the moment hard for him to end up too far left on this issue. I think part of the way that the parties have sort of sorted and polarized, there's less of a cost for a Democrat to be seen as too far left on trans issues. But I do think the issue is fluid. I think some of the policy questions about what you do with single gender institutions like girls' sports teams or women's only colleges are the implementation of a kind of civil rights agenda isn't always straightforward in those places. And so I think that this is going to be an issue that politicians of all parties will be wrestling with over the next decade.
We've tracked a pretty remarkable transformation here in a politician over many years. What's your takeaway on how the president has evolved on gay rights? And what does it say to you about the future?
I think Joe Biden has had, for 50 years now in public life, an exceptionally good nose for finding the sort of middle of his party on almost every issue. And I think it's a remarkable talent as a politician. And I think we see this on LGBT issues. He's sort of read the room, and I think he's sort of willing to be bolder on a lot of these issues now, make them more central to his political identity than he was 10 or 15 years ago, because the party coalition has made it easier for him.
Sasha Eisenberg is the author of the new book, The Engagement, America's Quarter Century Struggle Over Same-Sex Marriage. Sasha, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You might remember, you might also have held your breath, when Princess Diana walked through a minefield in post-war Angola in 1997 to draw attention to the work of the Halo Trust, which finds and clears out landmines and explosives around the world. Workers guided her.
We put in pioneering lanes to see what's going on. As you can see, they've been working away here, and they've excavated out, and they've uncovered a mine. Obviously, this is buried, so you would never have seen it.
Well, now, mine clearers working for that nonprofit have become the latest victims of the violence in Afghanistan as U.S. and NATO troops withdraw. 10 Halo Trust workers were killed in an attack on the compound where they were sleeping last night. More than a dozen others of the workers were injured. Afghanistan is one of several countries where large swaths of territory are littered with bombs and landmines, many planted by insurgents to target government military convoys, but civilian casualties are frequent. General James Cowan is a former British Army officer, now CEO at the Halo Trust. He joins us from London. General Cowan, so sorry. What a terrible loss.
Yeah, it's an appalling tragedy, and thank you for your kind words. The events of last night are now a matter of public record. Armed assailants broke into one of our camps where 110 of our staff were asleep, and they wanted to find members of the Hazara community. For those who don't know it, the Hazara are a ethnic minority within Afghanistan, and murdered 10 staff. They, in fact, did not find Hazara. The staff refused to name anybody who was Hazara. So there was remarkable courage and solidarity shown, and they ended up killing people at random. They murdered 10 young men in their beds, and a further 16 were wounded. You can imagine the chaos and the dark with the noise of gunfire, just what an appalling situation this was.
Well, but also, as you say, the heroism. And Afghan officials are now blaming the Taliban, but the Taliban deny that. And in fact, you told the BBC the Taliban has come to the aid of your workers. So let us know more about that.
Yeah, so I'm sure most listeners will believe that this is a war between the government and the Taliban. In fact, it's more complicated than that. What happened was that the local Taliban came to our rescue and chased the assailants away. And the assailants fled actually in a direction that where the Taliban are not present. So a little later, the Taliban also denied responsibility, and I am inclined to believe them. You know, there are other violent groups in Afghanistan, and this was probably one of them. So it is a more complicated picture than perhaps you might imagine. And I believe this was less about the work of the Halo Trust than it was about a vicious and violent assault upon a racial minority.
But still, you are, you know, perhaps the target of the work that you do, the work your workers do. They have to look out for these landmines. As, I mean, incredible work. And now over their shoulder at something else. Will you leave Afghanistan?
No. We started in Afghanistan in 1988 when the Russians were still there. We endured the civil war between the Taliban and the Northern Alliance. We were there during the Taliban regime in the late 90s, and we were there during 9/11. We've been there throughout all the NATO war from now until the present day. We're not quitters. We don't do exit strategies. We believe in staying there for the people we are here to help, namely the beneficiaries of our work. We make land safe for people to farm and live a peaceful life.
Well, this is why Diana walked across that field. I do remember holding my breath. Obviously, she wanted all of us to care as much about your workers as we did about her. What do you want us to know about these workers?
Well, they're not as famous as Princess Diana. She was a figure of global celebrity who made the world think about our cause. But I have 10,000 people who work for me around the world in different countries, often very violent and poor countries. They go about their work every day without the fame that accompanies celebrity. They do it for the wages we pay them and for the love of their countries. And they are quiet, unspoken heroes, and they deserve our thanks.
General James Cowan, CEO of the Halo Trust, thank you.
Thank you very much.
And we'll have a link at herenow.org to the nonprofit Halo Trust. And this program note, this afternoon on All Things Considered, a conversation with the Surgeon General, Vivek Murthy. As half of the eligible population, 12 and older, in the U.S. is now fully vaccinated, and as millions of people mourn the nearly 600,000 who've died. If you have one, you can tell your smart speaker to play NPR or ask for your member station by name. Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Robin Young.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.
We know you're busy, but if you have a minute, we'd love it if you would take a survey about your podcast listening. While you're at it, can you tell us more about what you like or don't like about Here and Now? The survey's anonymous, and we want to hear from everyone, those of you who've been listening to Here and Now for years and those who've just found us. Only takes a couple of minutes. It's at npr.org/podcastsurvey. Bring it. We can take it.